gentlemen. First of all, the court apologizes for the delay in beginning today's proceedings. We were necessarily delayed by a matter of beyond our control, and we appreciate everybody's thoughtfulness and patience in waiting. Before we begin the session today, it's my honor to introduce guests that we have here with us today. Sitting to my extreme right on the bench today is the Honorable Eiko Morioka, a judge of the District Court of Kanazawa, Japan. Judge Morioka is a visiting scholar at the University of Notre Dame for this year on sabbatical from her judicial duties, and is visiting the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit this morning, and this afternoon she will be a guest of Judge Aspin in the Northern District of Illinois. This is an opportunity for her to observe the attorneys and the court in actual practice after having studied our American legal system throughout this year. We also have with us a distinguished member of the Japanese Bar, Mr. Tomoyoko Shirai, a Japanese prosecutor. Mr. Shirai is also a visiting scholar at the University of Notre Dame this year on leave from his prosecutorial duties. After observing the court today, Mr. Shirai will be going to the Office of the United States Attorney for the Northern District and spending the afternoon with our prosecutors. We welcome our Japanese guests today and hope that they find our session informative in their study of the American system. With that said, we'll begin the court's calendar of the day. The first case is number 013448, Nanda against the Board of Trustees of the University of Illinois. Mr. Burke.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ed Burke, and I represent the University of Illinois in this appeal. this appeal is about constitutional power, and the exercise of that power by the Congress. And the Supreme Court, in the recent case of Garrett versus University of Alabama, sent a new message to Congress that in order for it to validly exercise its Section 5 power of the 14th Amendment, its legislation must not only be congruent and proportional, but importantly, when the legislation intends to abrogate state sovereign immunity, its legislative record must, and this is the new instruction, must, as a predicate, meet the new strict evidential standards laid out in Garrett.
Is that a separate element of the test, or is that part of the congruence test?
Your Honor, that's an extremely good question. I believe that it participates in the congruent and proportionality analysis, but it also constitutes, since Garrett, a separate requirement to validate Congress's Section 5 exercise of power. And this is why I say this, that in Garrett, there is a new rationale expressly stated, and it states that for the new predicate, the rationale for the new predicate requirements and the new evidential standards that Garrett sets out is that the states enjoy a presumption that they do not engage in unconstitutional behavior, unlike citizens. And the express language that I refer to is in the concurring opinion by Justices Kennedy and O'Connor. If the court will just bear with me, I'd like to read it because it's so important. It justifies and sets down the fundamental rationale for this new requirement. It states, it is a question of quite a different order, however, to say that states in their official capacities, the states as governmental entities, must be held in violation of the Constitution on the assumption that they embody the misconceived or malicious perceptions of some of their citizens. It is a most serious charge to say a state has engaged in a pattern or practice designed to deny its citizens the equal protection of the laws, particularly where the accusation is based, as here, not on hostility, but instead on the failure to act or the omission to remedy. Okay. States can and do stand apart from the citizenry. States act as neutral entities, ready to take instruction and to enact laws when their citizens so demand to change.
How is your position here consistent with how we interpreted Garrett in that Cherry case?
In the Cherry case. The Cherry case says that there's no bright line. There's no new bright line test here enunciated by Garrett. And frankly, we take a diametrically opposed position.
So we have to overrule a decision of our court from last year.
No, that's not required, because the EPA is different than Title VII. And it's different because...
I would think Title VII is a more far-reaching law.
I
agree. Is that why it's different?
Well, it's different in the way the legislation was enacted here. This Title VII legislation was enacted in 1964. The Civil Rights Act was passed in 64. In 1972, the only act that took place was to abrogate sovereign immunity. So the question is the congruence and proportionality. So that the application of the principles is different. The Cherry case can be distinguished. And so, no, it doesn't require an overruling of Cherry. But it does require a distinguishing, and the distinguishing should take place in the way this legislation was passed. Justice Kennedy and Justice O'Connor, to follow this rationale, Congress must overcome the presumption that states do not act unconstitutionally. And they must do it in the record. And Garrett consistently states that they throw out the old standards of evidence. They say, now you've got to have first-hand accounts. They have to be numerical, and they have to demonstrate that throughout the states this was a common widespread pattern.
Placing quite a burden on Congress, since it didn't know the rules of the game when it passed the statute, right?
That's what the Supreme Court is doing. I'm not doing it. The Supreme Court has said, if you're going to have a valid exercise of Section 5 power here, this is what you have to do.
How do you square this with the Supreme Court's general injunction to us not to pay too much attention to legislative history?
Well, I believe Garrett answers that. The Garrett new instruction in Garrett is defined by the debate that took place between the majority and the minority. They have clearly demonstrated by the minority's vigorous debate here, they have defined that this is a new instruction from the court to the Congress. It's the minority dissent that gives such strength to how the Congress must now act. A congressman sitting in his office now after Garrett is going to say, if I'm going to invade sovereign immunity and validly exercise my Section 5 power, this is what I have to do. I have to go out and I have to work hard. I've got to go out and get first-hand accounts of this kind of unconstitutional behavior throughout the state. But that isn't the only problem with this Title VII legislation. The proportionality of the remedy is also an issue here.
I just don't follow this, because you're saying that, what if Congress decided that one or two states were engaged in unconstitutional discrimination, but 48 other states were not? could Congress validly pass legislation
yes.
under your interpretation?
Yeah, and that's and that goes.
They found one state that was.
No. The Congress must find that under Garrett, and really not just under Garrett, under Kimmel and under City of Bourne and under prepaid, Florida prepaid, they must find a widespread pattern of this behavior, of unconstitutional behavior, in order for.
By all states?
No, I don't believe so. I believe that's for the courts to define, but I believe that there has to be a widespread pattern shown that demonstrated throughout the state. Not all, maybe not all the states, but also in this and in addressing Title VII here, to get back to a proportionate response, assuming that there were a widespread pattern had been shown to overcome the presumption, which we do not believe happened here, the Congress could have remedied these purported transgressions by a much less invasive remedy as to the states. They could have said, and this comes out of Florida prepaid, they could have said, the states, these remedies will apply to the states as long as and until the states provide a similar or a substantially similar remedy. And that would have been a proper exercise of Section 5 power. They did not do that. And you know what happened? We have 48 out of 50 states that has two systems of administrative agencies and two judicial systems handling the same identical problems. My white light's on. I'm going to say it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. We'll hear now from Ms. Harrington.
May it please the Court, my name is Sarah Harrington for the United States. There is no doubt that in extending the reach of Title VII to cover state employers, Congress complied with both of the requirements of Seminole Tribe and thereby validly abrogated the state's 11th Amendment immunity. First, as the university seems to concede, and as the Supreme Court held in Fitzpatrick v. Bitzer, Congress clearly expressed its intent to effect such an abrogation in the text of Title VII. And second, because Title VII's prohibitions of disparate treatment on the basis of race, sex, and national origin track the prohibitions of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment itself, it is appropriate Section 5 legislation. As this court held in Holman v. Indiana, Title VII is appropriate Section 5 legislation. In order for legislation to be valid under Section 5, there must be a congruence and proportionality between the remedial or preventive goal of the statute and the means adopted to reach that goal. Whereas here, a statute prohibits conduct that is also prohibited by Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, it is by definition congruent and proportional. In its recent decisions, the Supreme Court has reviewed putative Section 5 legislation by first determining the extent to which the statutory prohibitions track constitutional prohibitions. Title VII's prohibition of disparate treatment on the basis of race, sex, and national origin prohibits intentional discrimination, which is precisely the type of discrimination that is prohibited by the Equal Protection Clause. This court has concluded that the inquiry whether a government employer has violated the Equal Protection Clause is the same as the inquiry in a Title VII disparate.
Would that necessarily be true in a disparate impact case?
It would not. Disparate impact cases do not require a showing of intentional discrimination. This case does not involve a disparate impact claim.
I noticed that you seem to avoid talking about that in your brief. Do you think that we just simply don't need to rule on that today?
I do think that. I think courts have tended to rule on these issues according to the cause of action raised in the particular case.
Is that true of the earlier Supreme Court, the recent Supreme Court cases?
In Garrett, they limited their review to Title I of the ADA, although it was even arguable in that case that there was a Title II claim, but they limited their look just to Title I because that was the only statutory provision that was necessarily at issue in that case.
So you're not asking us to touch the impact issue?
No, sir. No, we're not. We believe that it is also appropriate Section 5 legislation as the 11th Circuit held in In-Ring Employment Discrimination and as the 8th Circuit held in Okrulik, but I don't think that's an issue in this case. It has not been briefed by the parties, so I think you
want to
talk about this.
How much legislative history should we look at to validate what Congress is?
In this case, I don't think you need to look at any legislative history. Legislative history is only appropriate to look at when statutory prohibitions go beyond what the Constitution prohibits. That's what this court held in Varner, that's what this court held in Cherry. In this case, the statutory provisions at issue here don't go beyond the Constitution at all, and in fact, with respect to sex and national origin, they are less restrictive than the Constitution.
So in a disparate impact case, you probably would have to go beyond, you would have probably have to look at the legislative history.
You might, we have argued, again, that you don't necessarily need to because, as with the Equal Pay Act, the Title VII's prohibition of disparate impact really targets unconstitutional state action. It doesn't go very much beyond the Constitution. It is really aimed at unconstitutional state action, so you might not need to look at very much, if any. But again, it's not an issue here, and there's certainly sufficient legislative history to support all of the enactments of Title VII. Contrary to the university's contentions, Title VII's prohibition, as I've said, does not need to be supported by legislative history. As this court held in Varner and Cherry, when the statute is limited to prohibiting unconstitutional state action, that's all the court needs to determine. They don't need to look at the evidence or frequency of such violations by states. That's how the Supreme Court acted. In Kimmel, Florida, Prepaid, and Garrett, they examined the legislative history only after they determined that most of the conduct prohibited by those statutes was in fact constitutionally permissible. And in those cases, they only looked at the legislative record to determine whether there was sufficient evidence of unconstitutional state action to justify the broad reach of those statutes. Contrary to what the university has said, Garrett doesn't change that analysis at all. This court held in Cherry, if I may quote very briefly, that all Garrett does is further demonstrate that the legislative record is an important factor when the statute in question prohibits constitutional state action. That is not the case here. Race, sex, and national origin discrimination are unlike either age discrimination, patent infringement, or even disability discrimination, which were the types of conduct examined by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized this country's long history of unconstitutional state-sponsored discrimination on the basis of race, sex, and national origin, and has determined that those types of discrimination in state employment are unconstitutional. Because the court has determined that states have engaged and have a history of engaging in that unconstitutional action, it is irrelevant what sort of record was before Congress in 1972 when it extended the reach of Title VII to cover states. But even if Congress were required to compile a legislative record in this case, there is ample evidence in the legislative history to support the extension of Title VII to cover states. Congress held extensive legislative hearings and received reports from the executive branch on the subject of these types of discrimination in state employment. The hearings presented ample evidence that these types of discrimination were common and that existing remedies were inadequate to address the problem. Congress specifically found that employment discrimination was a problem in state educational institutions such as the defendant, and they identified that that conduct was violative of the 14th Amendment. For all of these reasons, Title VII's prohibitions of disparate treatment on the basis of race, sex, and national origin are valid Section 5 legislation, and we urge this court to uphold the district court's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Harrington. We'll hear now from Mr. Krimp.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Larry Crean. Dr. Nanda. Your Honors, what the university is asking this court to do in this case is frightening. It's dangerous. It would undo what this country, the progress this country has made after years of demonstrations, riots in the streets to remedy discrimination of all kinds. And if this court holds that there is an 11th Amendment immunity to Title VII, then what it will do is eviscerate the 14th Amendment, and it will render the rights to due process and equal protection illusory. You can't let that happen. This university claims to agree that Title VII in the private sector is justified and it's valuable and it's necessary and it's a proper exercise of Congress's power. And in their reply brief, they even claim to recognize and respect what they call the sacred constitutionally protected rights in Title VII. Yet at the same time, they say that as a state entity, they have the sovereign right to deny those same rights to their own employees. Furthermore, the university says Congress is powerless to do anything about it. This court should squarely reject any such notion. The university claims the 11th Amendment trumps, in their words, any federal legislation that threatens a state's fundamental structure and design. I would submit, Your Honors, that it is not, and never has been, the function of the fundamental structure of a state to deny its employees due process and equal protection of law. The 11th Amendment says no state shall deprive any person of due process and equal protection. It doesn't say no state shall deprive any person except state employees. And the university says states are co-equal sovereigns with the federal government. I think the university should read Fitzpatrick again and listen to its own professors, because what the Civil War established is that they're not. The states gave up sovereignty in the 14th Amendment, particularly as it relates to respecting the rights of their citizens, their own employees, to due process and equal protection. And despite what they say, this isn't a case about states' rights. This isn't the state suffering under the oppressive boot heel of the federal government. This is a university that wants a free rein to violate the constitutional rights of its professors. For the university, this case is a power struggle between the faculty and the administration. Because if anybody has the guts to stand up to them, like Dr. Nanda did, they're going to delay. They're going to raise every defense they think they can do. They ignored the EEOC here when they found a reasonable cause to believe in discrimination had occurred. They would not engage in a conciliation conference. They ignored two resolutions of their own Senate asking that she be reinstated. And now the university wants this court to ignore 26 years of precedent since Fitzpatrick, that Congress was well within its power to extend Title VII to the states. This court should not compound the injustice she's already suffered by accepting this argument. And the issue here shouldn't be whether Congress had the power to extend Title VII to the states. It clearly did. They admit that. And the issue isn't whether Title VII made conduct unlawful that previously was constitutional. They admit that as well. And the issue also is not whether before the 1972 amendments there really in truth and in fact was a history of discrimination in state employment and in universities in particular. The university doesn't challenge the litany of cases we cite showing that our courts have repeatedly recognized that there was such a history. I don't think they're claiming, Judge, that prior to 1972 there was no discrimination and it miraculously appeared later but Congress forgot to document. And instead, I think the university's entire case here is based upon the erroneous contention that despite what may be true in the real world, that Congress is powerless to do anything about pervasive discrimination on the basis of race, national origin, or gender, unless it sufficiently documents it in the record. This court, I thought, answered that question in Varner too, and again in Cherry, with respect to the Equal Pay Act, that even Garrett, upon which they're basing their whole case, rejects any argument that Congress has to document pervasive discrimination before it can pass legislation such as Title VII. And what the Supreme Court did in Garrett, Justice Rehnquist, the author of Garrett, or of Fitzpatrick, reaffirms Fitzpatrick and holds Title VII out as the paradigm, as the gold standard of the kind of legislation that is well within Congress's power under Section 5. This court, I think, properly recognized that in Varner and Cherry and should do so here. I only have a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to address the injunction issue briefly. The only issue raised in the district court was whether these individual defendants were persons under 1983, and the district court properly held that they were. The university never raised the issue it now raises, that they're not the ones that, even if they were ordered to reinstate Dr. Nanda, that they could do so. They were the ones who fired her, Your Honors. They had the power to reinstate her. The court has the power to order this, and if you look at the complaint, we're asking for much broader relief than merely reinstatement in the injunction. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Burke, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, the appellee's positions are simply that Garrett doesn't address the issue of legislative record. That's their position, and that's bizarre. When you read the Garrett opinion in its entirety, a good 70% of the opinion addresses the legislative record, and the debate between the majority and the dissent and the dissenting justices is fierce, and if it was not, no, if it was still not determinative, the legislative record, as set out in City of Bourne and mentioned in Florida Prepaid. If that were true, what is all this debate about? If there was no new standard put out here, what is all this debate about? They're wasting their time. I don't think that's what happened. They set out a new presumption for the state. They presumed not to have engaged in this kind of behavior, unless the Congress can show by firsthand evidence that they do engage in this unconstitutional activity. It is true that with respect to the congruence aspect of Title VII, that it is more likely, because once you buy into and once you accept the classifications that we must when dealing with discrimination, then it is more likely that in gender and national origin and race that this statute does comply with the Section 1 protection. It's more likely than that. When you get into the remedy, this remedy is not proportionate. And when you deal, for example, with the remedy, Prepaid is a good precedent, because that's dealing not with discrimination, but with the Patent Remedy Act. And you have a property due process question. And there, they said, well, it's not determinative, but if you read that case carefully, even though they say the legislative record is not determinative, they say, however, the lack in the legislative record demonstrates clearly there's no proportionality, and therefore, we're going to dump this statute. So they go off more on proportionality than they do on congruence in the Florida Prepaid case. But this doctrine of states' rights is a progressive doctrine here in the current Supreme Court. They are proceeding on a progressive way, and this statement that states are presumed not to have engaged in unconstitutional behavior until it's proven otherwise is a new progression in that analysis. And so, with respect to proportionality on this case, similar to Prepaid, Congress did not provide for a restrictive remedy so as to avoid all these double systems and all the judicial waste and all the administrative waste that is now going on in the United States. With respect to the Cherry case, I would like to address that a little bit, and Okrulik, both these cases, they say, well, you know what? The legislative record, here's how we're going to patch up this legislative record. And Cherry especially knows there's no record here, or there was no record in EPA, and there's no record here to justify the overcoming of that presumption. And this is a headache, I think, for all the circuits, this new language in Garrett. I think you're going to have a lot of challenges to sovereign immunity legislation that does away with sovereign immunity. And why? With this new language. This Fuller Love case, with the idea that you can look at other legislative records that's going through the Congress at the same time, that isn't what Garrett says. You can't. Garrett doesn't say that. First of all, Fuller Love is not a Section 5 case, and it's not a sovereign immunity case. It had nothing to do with any of that. It was the 10% set aside, and Klutznik, the Secretary of Commerce, was sued in that case. It had nothing to do with Section 5. It had nothing to do with the sovereign immunity, 11th Amendment. And secondly, Fuller Love or Garrett doesn't. Nothing in this legislative record references in other. Historical or jurisprudence or other legislative acts. They don't even mention that. And Rehnquist in Garrett expressly states if they didn't even reference it, it couldn't possibly be utilized to substantiate their incursion here into sovereign immunity. And so Fuller Love doesn't do the job. It doesn't create the record that wasn't created by Congress in the act that they enacted. So, you know, I could go on forever on this, and I'm sure that I appreciate, I notice my time is up, I appreciate, the university appreciates all your attention here, and we thank you very much.
Our thanks to all counsel for their fine presentations today. The case will be taken under advisement.